This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Diatoms, they are a type of single-celled algae found all over the world. They're considered a model organism, a staple in labs studying ocean water quality. They're like the little white mice used to study human health. Well, diatoms are that for marine microbiology research. In fact, they are so well studied that some facts about diatoms seem irrefutable. For instance, we know that they only reproduce asexually. Of course, that means by a single-cell division. Or so we thought, until one of those happy accidents we're always hearing about in science. My next guest caught a subset of diatoms in the act of sexual reproduction. Kimberly Halsey is assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology at Oregon State University. Dr. Halsey, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Are you sort of the Masters and Johnson of diatom sex research?
Well, by accident, that's for sure. It definitely was a serendipitous discovery, so we've been learning a lot fast.
Tell us how you made that serendipitous discovery.
Oh, well, a lot of these stories start with a graduate student, and so Eric Moore, graduate student working in my lab, was studying something else. He was studying how diatoms, you know, maybe share information, share carbon, share maybe vitamins. He was interested in seeing how diatoms might share these compounds with bacteria and other organisms in the ocean. And so to do that, he had to first kind of get over a big hurdle, and that was that he needed to devise a new culturing medium. So this is the seawater-like stuff that we create a recipe for that we can grow these cells in. So he had to make this new media that could grow both the diatom that we were studying and a bacterium at the same time. So he worked on this for a couple of months, and finally he had this great concoction that he'd developed, and it seemed that both the diatom and the bacterium he was studying could grow in this medium. So that was a great thing. Except that after a couple of weeks, he came into my office and he said, he had that look of concern, and he said, you know, the bacteria are growing great, but the diatoms just look really strange. And so I said, well, what do you mean? What do you mean they look strange? And he said, well, I don't know. They just get really clumpy. They look bigger than they're supposed to look. And I said, well, did you look at them under the microscope? And he said, no, and he kind of looked sheepish. And I have to say, this is one of those things that I think the most underutilized instrument in the laboratory in microbiology, unfortunately, is probably the microscope. So we ended up looking under the microscope, and so we saw what we expected to see, some of these cells that look like little miniature cylinders. They look like what I would call little teeny tiny old-fashioned hat boxes, you know, with a lid and a bottom. And then, but we also saw these other shapes in this culture that looked like gigantic beach balls. And I said, you know, I looked at Eric and I said, Eric, I don't know what you're growing, but you're not growing the diatom you're supposed to be growing. You've contaminated the culture and you need to start over. And you need to clean everything and make new media and start from scratch. And so this was sort of this long road to realizing that, in fact, after he repeated and repeated, it turned out that, you know, eventually you have to believe your data. And so we said, something else is going on here. And that's when we realized that these organisms were undergoing the sexual pathway instead of just regular single-cell division. They were undergoing sexual reproduction, and that was a shock.
Wow. So why would they decide to do that versus the asexual one you've always been familiar with?
Well, that's the big question. Why were they undergoing sex? And it was great because we were suddenly in this position where Eric had two types of culturing medium, one in which they were always just going through regular cell division, and then this other medium that every time he grew them in this new medium, they would go into sex. And so he took this laborious path to try to figure out what chemicals were inducing sex, because never before has anybody ever really been able to reliably induce sex in diet toms. They can sometimes capture it in the environment like a freak event, but we can now reliably cause this to happen. So we can trigger sex every time. So what he found out was that this really common ingredient in the laboratory, ammonium, stimulates sex in these organisms.
And that's like fish waste, isn't it? Isn't that like the waste that
it is. It is like fish waste, and it's also released by the organisms that come along and eat these diatoms. The thought is perhaps that when these organisms are growing, possibly their predators might come along and chew on them. And what they do is they excrete ammonium, and maybe that will stimulate the sex response in the environment. This is a hypothesis. We don't know yet.
So, to continue this X-rated interview, could I then assume that anytime you wanted a diatom to have sex, you could just put some ammonium in their medium?
Well, that's what it looks like. For these particular diatoms, which are a large group of the overall diatom group, these diatoms that look like cylinders, it seems to be that if we add ammonium, and in fact, the more ammonium you add, the more sex you get. So it looks like the most reliable method that anybody's ever developed. And it's been a long road to try to understand what might trigger sex.
Well,
so
let's just.
This is pretty exciting.
So, just so we understand this is ammonium works in diatoms. You have no reference to people anywhere here in triggering sex.
No.
This is the internet,
but
you know.
We do, people... You know, there's been a lot of fun in the lab after this discovery, that's for sure.
So, do you think the finding influences how researchers study diatoms then? I mean, what is their niche in the ecosystem?
Well, so diatoms are these amazing organisms, and I would encourage anybody that wants to, you know, Google diatoms and look at them up really up close and personal. They are beautiful. One of the things that makes them super unique is they have these silica cell walls, which means that they really do live in glass houses, okay? So they are surrounded in silica. And so their place in the environment, they're really good at, so remember these are plants, so they're really, really good at growing fast under low light conditions. So they're unique in that regard too. So every year, predictably, when we're coming out of the winter and just starting to get enough light in the springtime, you can reliably see really huge diatom blooms in the ocean. Hmm. And that's because they kind of get this head start because they can grow really fast when the light is really low. So they end up, because of this ability, they end up making these huge blooms that contribute a massive amount of carbon to the oceanic system. So they have a huge role in the carbon cycle.
Interesting. Will the warming of the oceans or affect their cycle and their how they live in the oceans?
Well, there's a lot of ideas about that. One hypothesis is that as the oceans warm, one possibility is that there will be less nutrients that move up towards the surface, and even more important maybe for diatoms is that even less silica might move into the surface waters. And so that limitation, without that silica that they need for their cell walls, they're going to have a really hard time perhaps growing to these massive blooms that we're typically seeing on an annual basis. But that's just a hypothesis right now. So we don't know.
All right. So I'm going to give you the Science Friday $64 question. If you had unlimited budget and you wanted to study diatoms and you could spend any amount of money, what do you know and what would you need? What would you like to know?
Wow, that's a great question. What I would like to know is really what I want to nail down what the ecology of sex is in the environment. So I want to know the answer to this question about whether or not other plankton like zooplankton, larger critters that come along and eat these diatoms. I want to know if that actually does trigger sex, like in a stress response, or maybe there's another way that sex is triggered. The next thing I want to know is, what happens after you've got this new sexual reproduction? What's the purpose in the environment? So they now, diversify their genetics. They create these larger cells as a result of cell division and this whole sexual reproduction process. The new initial cell that's formed in the process is really large compared to the original cell. And so one thought is that maybe as a result of that, those large cells end up sinking deeper into the ocean. And maybe that's a place where they can basically hide out and get redistributed into other areas in the ocean. These are the questions I want to ask. Some of that is going to require just some hardcore lab experiments. Some of that would also require maybe a lot of, genetic sequencing technologies or sort of looking for gene expression changes. Those are the questions
I'm
excited
passionate.
About.
You're so passionate about this subject. Where does that come from?
Well, it's a lot of fun. Lab work is a ball. Science is great. I feel really privileged to get to do it. So, yeah, we have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, continue having fun. And I think you've created some great conversation topic for tonight for people.
I hope so. If people are talking about diatom sex on their Friday evenings over a beer, that'd be great.
I'm sure they will now. I will. Kimberly Halsey is assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology at Oregon State University. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and keep us informed of your work.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. After the break, we're going to journey into move from diatoms into ants, another small creature. And they build magnificent towers that you've probably never seen. They look just like the Eiffel Tower. And we're going to be talking about fire ants, and they do it with their own bodies. It's another great story to talk about. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you ever have one of those ant farms when you're growing up? You know what I mean. It's one of those clear plastic colonies where you can see the ants excavating dirt to build those intricate passageways and the tunnels and the caverns and all the stuff they do. It's really captivating to watch, to see how industrious these insects are and to witness the designs they create when they're doing their little building. And how do they know what to build and where to do that? Well, the ants' feats of engineering are not limited to the underground, because my next guest finds fire ants, much to the bane of his university colleagues, I should add. And the reason he's curious about studying fire ants is because the stinging insects build impressive sinking towers, which are constantly melting and being built up again. And I know they build these fluid-like structures with their bodies. How do they do it? Here to tell us more is David Hugh. He's an associate professor of mechanical engineering and biology at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Welcome back to Science Friday, David.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here.
Okay, since we're on radio, and I know you've been here before, describe for us, paint us a picture of these towers that the ants built.
Well, each ant is only a couple millimeters tall. But the towers themselves are several inches. So it's the equivalent of a 30-story building. And they got to find a sort of stem or a twig to brace themselves against. But once they do, the tower on the very top looks tall and pointy. And then as it gets closer to the bottom, it starts billowing out, kind of like the Eiffel Tower, so that it's got quite a wide base.
So they're building like a human pyramid, like cheerleaders do.
Yeah, that's exactly the right analogy, because the ants, unlike bricks, they actually have limits to how much forces they can take. I was actually in one of these human cheerleading pyramids before, and it's not so bad to be on the top. You're just sort of like waving around. But if you're at the bottom of one of these things, it's just crushing.
Let me just give out a Twitter handle, at SciFry, if you'd like to get in on the conversation about these fire ants. Why do you think the ants do this?
They only do this in an emergency, when they're trying to basically escape some kind of container, or They also do this to anchor onto vegetation. So they are actually evolved in the wetlands of Brazil, this place called the Pantanal, which is great for most months of the year, but for the rainy season, it actually floods down to a meter deep. And so these ants in their underground homes, they start getting wet and they have to escape, so they build these rafts. Now, the rafts would float out to ocean unless they started anchoring onto things. And so if they find some nearby vegetation, the raft will actually sort of extend a little kind of pseudopod, kind of like an amoeba, and then it'll grab onto a twig, and then it's got to sort of morph from this sort of pancake shape into basically building a permanent structure to wait for a few months. And that's what this ant tower is.
And do all ant colonies do it, or just the fire ants?
There's about 10,000 species of ants spread across all the continents, and only the army ants and the fire ants, which constitute about 100 species, so a very small fraction, have this ability to pile themselves up on top of each other or link together and build sort of large aggregates. The other ants, they can build chemical trails and things, but they can't really build these large structures like these fire ants do.
Mm-hmm. Did E.O. Wilson ever study this stuff?
I think he mentioned in his book that he was one of the first to observe the fire ants coming in and from Alabama. They came on maybe a boat of fruit. But one of the reasons they haven't been studied before is because it takes them a really long time to build them. I mean, actually, if you watch fire ants for hours and hours, it doesn't seem like they're doing anything. They've got to have the right conditions, and you've got to be really patient, and they've got to really want to escape.
So, who starts the building? Who says, hey, guys, let's all build some pyramid here?
Well, it's kind of like it emerges from all of them looking together. So, for example, if they're in a bin, they know to build these things at the corners of the bin. And I think what happens is that they try at different locations. Maybe one ant says, let's start something here, and he'll basically send out some pheromones and gather two ants, which will gather four ants and eventually get a couple thousand. And they'll try to build on sort of the flat edges of the container, kind of like a wall. But the problem is there's just not enough places they can get support. So they really sort of build and build, and it might get into something like 10 ants tall by literally the ants piling themselves on top of each other. But then the whole thing will just, it just kind of flops over. So it's really just a process of trial and error until they find the right location, which from our experience turns out to be sort of a round, they build around twigs that emerge vertically,
yeah,
or around sort of the corners of a bin where they can really brace themselves up against.
Yeah, we have a little video on our website of showing the fire ants building, I guess, from your lab, sort of like a tube in the middle, and they climb up the tube and form
a
tower.
Yeah, they're building around a watering hole. So if they find a source of water, I think maybe they also try to protect it. So they'll actually pile up and actually surround and cover up this pool of water so that no other insects can access it.
Now, I hear that studying these ants has made you the most hated professor in the biology department. Is that correct?
I think there's a consensus about that, I'm the most hated professor at Georgia Tech School of Biology. And that's because, we really do a good job of trying to keep the ants in containers. We've built an ant Alcatraz. We've taken big containers and this goes beyond mentioned these ant farms that you buy. We buy liquid Teflon, what's called Fluon, and we coat the rims of all these containers. And so these containers are several inches tall. I mean, it would be impossible for an ant to escape with this Fluon because they basically can't grip. They just slide down the walls. So imagine a container with just completely slippery walls that are many, many times your height. You can't even see the top. So we leave them in there. And things are going fine for one day, and we check on the ant bins every day, and sometimes they'll build small walls and things like that. But, every once in a while there's a three-day weekend, and that means they actually have enough time to assemble their troops. And so there's this one Memorial Day weekend, it was last year, and we didn't check on them for 3 days. And so what happens is that they'll eventually get wise, and they'll find this corner of the bin, and they'll pile up their entire colony. That's 100,000 ants. That's five times the student body of Georgia Tech. And they'll pile them up, and they'll build these Eiffel Tower-shaped structures. And They do this by just such process of trial and error. If they built them straight up and down, they would crush the individual ants and they would go anywhere. But if they build them in this particular shape, they're called towers of constant strength, that they can build them basically as high as they want without the ants hurting themselves. So they build this at the edge of the structure, and eventually they get to the top, and it kind of looks like a siege tower, basically this pile of ants near the edge of the structure, and it looks like a ramp. And so they pull all their fellow ants out of the container. So it's 100,000 ants, slowly, but they go out and march out of the container, and then they go down. We have a little shelf. They go down the shelf and then go down the walls, and then they go down my floor, and then we've got this little crack under the door where the entire 100,000 ants will march out of the crack. And there's this unfortunate professor's office that's just right across from my lab, and it seems like a good place for them. So they'll just go across the hall, and 100,000 ants will march under the door. And then I think it was probably sometime Monday morning that they started building an ant tower under his desk. And so, you know, professors in biology, they wear Birkenstocks and flip-flops and things. So this guy comes in and he goes and he, no one's in the office door is locked. So he goes and sits down at his desk and his foot touches something soft. And he looks down and he sees there's this huge pile of fire ants right under his desk. And of course he thinks the first thing is I laid a terrible practical joke on him that I basically found the key and opened his door and let in all these ants because they're just literally sitting there guarding their tower. They've got tons of eggs. They've got tons of food. They're really there to settle down. So he calls me and just curses me for about 15 minutes. And then I said, no, the ants did it themselves and I'm trying to study it. So I think he finally understood, but I did have to pay for the exterminators to come and remove all the other ants from the rest of the building. They gave me a warning.
What a story. Wow. I know what I see where your reputation comes from. I have a tweet from Alex who says, has specific communication chemicals associated with building been discovered? I guess the pheromones you were talking about. Have you discovered what they are?
The ants have about 100 different types of pheromones, some of them for alarm, some of them for basically tracking food. The ones that they tell them to gather, it might be similar to they have little ant cemeteries where they actually, you know, ants actually keep all their bodies in one mass grave. But they don't plan it like that. They actually put little cemeteries all over the place, and eventually the ants figure out how to gather them all into one place. So it might be a pheromone that attracts them, but it also might be the ants are also attracted to themselves. They like staying together. So it just might be once you get a few of them there, the other ones sort of get a positive, what they call positive feedback, where as soon as one ant goes, then another ant goes, then another one, and all of them sort of get there. So we haven't identified the pheromone. It definitely doesn't make the tower process happen any faster. It takes almost 20 minutes for them to build every single layer. And eventually it's 20 stories tall. So it Wow. takes them a long amount of time.
Ariel wants to know, Ariel Zitch, our education director, is tweeting. She says, do all ants do this or just some? You said 100,000 ants. That must mean the whole colony is headed out the door there. And why some and not others?
So the tower building is it's really a group effort. So out of those 100,000 ants, they'll all be different sizes too. I mean, the biggest ant will weigh almost 10 times as much as the smallest one. And we haven't seen any kind of coordination. For example, I mean, if they were ants were cheerleaders, I would want to put, you know, the big ones on the bottom. But and this is part of the beauty of the ant towers themselves. They're not trying to build it. It's something that just emerges. They don't actually know they're trying to build a tower. They just have these rules they follow. And when ants get there, this thing emerges just from their interactions. Oh. So they don't know that they're going to build a tower. They don't know how tall it's going to get. And they don't even know if they're ever going to stop. So because of all those things, they can't coordinate, you know, let's say the biggest ants go on the bottom and the, you know, the lightest, smallest ants go on the top. It just, whatever happens to get there, gets there first.
Wow. So you wear another hat, both two hats as a biologist and engineer. So this engineering feat must be fascinating to you. I mean, not even planning ahead for and building these things and getting
it. Yeah, it's like if the what really struck me, the first time, I still remember the first time I saw this, these ant towers. And First, I was struck by how tall it was. I mean, I'd never seen ants build anything that's basically, 20 stories tall. It's very, very tall for an ant. The next thing I thought, I was like, this shape, it looks a lot like the Eiffel Tower. And it struck me, there's this old book written in the 1920s by Timoshenko. He was kind of a contemporary of Eiffel. And they wanted to break the world's record for tallest tower. And the ideas at the time were just to use very strong materials and just stack them as tall as possible. But no matter what material you use, you basically hit a limit. For example, if you just stack people on top of each other, eventually a person just can't hold, mm-hmm. you just can't support more than three, or for me, one person on their shoulders for very long periods of time. And so no matter what material you use, if you make the tower straight up and down, it's going to be limiting. So what Eiffel thought and what Timoshenko thought, they thought about these ideas of what they called towers of constant strength. And basically, it's a principle that you can use to build a tower as tall as you want, no matter what material you make it. And the idea is that for example, like I mentioned, if you're at the top of the tower, you're not supporting any load because you're not having anyone on top of you. If you're in the middle of the tower, you're supporting about half that tower's weight, which could be very heavy. And if you're bottom of the tower, that's the worst place to be because you're supporting the entire weight of this thing. And so instead of making it basically constant cross-section where each cross-section is supporting, more and more weight as you go away from the top, Timoshenko thought, let's make each cross-section bigger. Let's make it sort of trumpet-shaped. So let's make it wider correspondingly to how much weight we have to support.
Let me just interrupt you there. I have to rudely, and I get criticized soundly for having to interrupt my guest. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Forgive me. That's a great story.
Oh, no problem.
Keep going.
Okay.
You're up to the trumpet shape.
So they got this idea, this trumpet shape, to basically make each cross-section wider support the load that it needs to support. And if you do that, you can actually just make this tower as tall as you want because you just as it gets heavier, it gets wider and wider. And so the ants have basically figured this out. But they did it by basically just moving randomly and having this little trick up their sleeve. Which is basically as soon as the tower starts assembling shapes that are just simply too heavy in one place, sort of too straight up and down, they just decide to disintegrate it. They create little avalanches. I mean, I don't hear any little explosions. It actually sounds a little more like, because the ants are kind of they're kind of really spongy. But basically, as they build this thing, you see avalanches here and there, and over a process of just accretion, you get parts of the tower breaking away until what you have left emerges is this shape that Timoshenko predicted, this Eiffel Tower shape that allows them to build it to much higher than they would ordinarily be able to build without following the shape rule.
We have a tweet from Hester, who's doing her master's work in fire ants. She said, "My fire ants would escape to steal food from neighboring colonies. I lost 2 data points each time. Very frustrating work for master's work." You agree? You seem to really enjoy it, though. I mean,
Oh, the fire ants escaping?
Well, just the whole work with fire. Well, I don't know about that. Well, we have another tweet that says, from Uday, he says, "What's being done for the ant accident not to happen at GA Tech?" maybe put some gauze in there to close off the top? Or what?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I also can't help just rooting for the fire ants because they're doing almost impossible tasks. You give them 3 days and they're working 24 hours a day to build this thing. So it's not that I want them to escape, but I was at a conference. Someone suggested something very innovative that could prevent all escapes forever. They said, "Why don't you just put a lid on it?" And I thought about it, but the ants need this 12-hour light-dark cycle. They get unhappy if they're all in the dark. We have to access them regularly, so we just like to have the top open.
Give them a lot of air. Need some sunlight in the air. Fascinating, David. Thank you very much for sharing this with us. This is great. The Tower of Ants. David Hugh is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering and Biology. He's a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Thanks again, David. Have a good weekend.
Thanks a lot, Ira. Take care.
We're going to take a break, and after we're going to come back and talk about a new film that documents the devastation of bleaching coral in overheated ocean waters. Why we should be motivated instead of depressed by all that coral dying off, especially in Australia. We'll talk about it After the break, stay with us. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's estimated that as much as 30% of Australia's Great Barrier Reef died last year thanks to bleaching. That's that ghostly byproduct of warming and acidifying oceans that is afflicting reefs around the globe. The stressed coral turns white, and they often die. But in the new documentary, Chasing Coral, Ant-Man-turned-ocean activist Richard Vevers describes his first encounter with bleaching coral.
I was truly shocked by what I saw. The reef was white as far as the eye could see. Was this dead? Was it alive?
Vevers is just one figure in Chasing Coral, which documents the scope of recent bleaching events in painstaking time lapses of reefs before and after they've bleached and died. The documentary is out today on Netflix and in selected theaters around the country. You can see a sample of that documentary on our website, sciencefriday.com/reef. But the good news is that it's not all bad news. The film's director says he wants viewers to be inspired by this story. It's not too late to act, he says. Like what if we could breed or teach coral to be more resilient to warmer waters? There are researchers working on just that. And I have a couple of guests here to talk about the story of coral and why we should care, and some of those bits of hope. Let me introduce them. Jeff Orlowski is a director of Chasing Coral. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ira.
You're welcome. Ruth Gates is professor and director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in Kaneohe, Hawaii. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira.
Jeff, you went from chasing melting glaciers to chasing bleaching coral. Are they one is moving, you know, slower than the other?
One moves a little bit slower, but the changes are all sort of becoming faster than we anticipated. We had worked on a previous project documenting glaciers, and through that process, we met a bunch of scientists and met some photographers and started learning through Richard Vevers, that subject that you mentioned. We started learning about what was happening in the ocean, and we realized we wanted to point our cameras literally under the water and document what was happening there.
Is one more convincing about climate change than the other when you're looking at both of them?
I actually do think so, very much so. In part, I think people who are on the fence about climate change, certainly the glacier story has been around for quite a while now, and people have their explanations. If they aren't familiar with how fast the rates of change are happening in the Arctic, they might just rule it off and think that glaciers have always changed. They've always come and gone, and they might not get a sense of the time scales that the scientists are talking about. Hmm. When you look in the ocean and you look at the coral bleaching that's happening right now, this does not fit any natural cycle whatsoever. And the changes are so dramatic, and they're speeding up, and they're happening so powerfully that it really can be this wake-up call that that I hope people can view the footage, view the film, and see for themselves what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gates, we saw a major loss of the Great Barrier Reef in 2016. Give us a picture of how bad it is for coral worldwide.
Well, it's really bad. I mean, I recently gave a talk, and I said, had I given this talk a year ago or 18 months ago, I would have said 30% of the world's reefs had died. But this year, we're saying 50% of the world's reefs had died. That means we lost approximately 20% last year during this very intense warming event that affected not only large parts of the Great Barrier Reef, but many, many other reefs worldwide.
Huh. And Jeff, describe to our listeners what a bleaching event looks like before and after.
Yeah, so very few people have gone scuba diving. It's only about 1% of the world population. And before this project, I had never really spent much time underwater. A coral reef is an incredibly beautiful, colorful, biologically diverse ecosystem. And when the temperature starts to rise, those corals effectively get a little bit sick, and they basically turn transparent. You can see through to their skeleton underneath the coral animal. And that landscape now looks completely white. Just imagine walking through your nearby forest, and you went for a hike. Mm-hmm. You've been doing the same hike for years and years and years, and one day you just go there, and all the trees have just turned white. It is startling. It's shocking. It looks very, very strange.
Ruth, just to clarify, the fact that the coral is bleached doesn't mean it's totally dead. I mean, you're dead. You're totally dead yet, does it?
No, that's correct. I mean, really, it's a race against time. So the higher the seawater temperatures, the longer the exposure of a coral to bleaching conditions, the more likely it is that that coral will die. And so, you know, you can have very, very short but very extreme high temperatures that can kill a lot of corals very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But sometimes a bleached coral will recover if the temperature comes down. So large storms can come in and drop the water temperature very quickly, and that is a good thing for corals.
So why is the coral the part of the ocean we should worry most about under climate change?
You know, it's this, well, you know, we often talk about them as these places where lots of things convene, but really what that means is 25% of organisms that live in the sea spend some time on a coral reef, because there are so many nooks and crannies that so many different types of things can live in. And many of those things end up on our plate, are critical to food security. 500 million people are directly affected by the presence of reefs. They're also these incredible natural seawalls. So they protect the land behind them from major storms that come in from the open ocean. And that's critical because it really maintains the land that we live on. And so when a reef dies, the land directly behind them now is not protected and often erodes away. And many people live very close to the ocean, as you know. So that is very bad news for the people who live there. So, you know, these reefs, they serve so many fundamentally important purposes, and they are intimately linked to human health.
How much of the damage to the reefs comes from global climate change, and how much from runoff from the land, let's say, in Australia?
I mean, that's a great question. And what we've observed is that the majority of the death or major losses in corals occur around these very large warming events that we've had one in 1998, in 2010, and now 2016. But they are made worse by the fact that the corals themselves are chronically stressed by things that happen just right adjacent to them. And you touched on the runoff from really, you know, large amounts of water coming on in rain events and pollution. And there's been a lot of discussion of sunscreen. None of that is good. I mean, it's like living in Beijing where you've got like, you know, a haze of poor air quality. That's what it's like for a coral living close to humans that are polluting the water.
Mm-hmm. Jeff White, why do you feel it's so important that people see this in real time, and you show it in real time? And let me just back up a second. Describe how difficult it was to actually film what you saw.
Yeah, for us, the challenge was figuring out where to be on the planet at the right time. So we worked with scientists like Ruth and scientists from NOAA using satellite data to predict where these bleaching events were going to happen. And then we took specially built custom cameras that could do long-term time lapses underwater in these conditions. And we went around the planet and we deployed these camera systems to try to capture that before, during, and after process of the bleaching. And for me, you know, this is a very visual landscape. You know, everybody has seen underwater footage at some point in their life because these landscapes are just so spectacular and so beautiful. And to be down there and to see this stuff happen, once you see it, it's pretty hard to forget. And for us, we kept meeting scientists. We kept speaking with different experts who had seen what had happened and they knew what was going on. And we wanted to be able to use film as a tool to capture that so we could share it with the world.
We have a tweet coming in from Renee. She says, please talk about what an individual can do about coral bleaching. I want my children to grow up in a world with these reefs.
Ruth, you want to start with that?
I mean, can we bring
Absolutely.
These back? Can we seed them with, you know, better warm water tolerant coral?
There are two things that we can do. We can either we can influence and change the things that are driving the coral bleaching. And, of course, that's the most important thing that we can do, which really involves the backing off on the reliance of fossil fuel burning and the embracing of renewable technologies and renewable energy. And it's doable right now. It's economically viable. It's an easy thing for us to do. And frankly, that's the most important thing that we can do. But as we get on with the doing that, we're starting to explore how we can help the biology, the corals themselves, survive the warmer and more acidic water that is surrounding them at this time. And so we're looking into whether we could potentially selectively breed corals that are apparently surviving conditions that are killing others. You know, so there are two really very, very different approaches. And frankly, you know, we would hope not to have to engineer the biology to survive a future that we have basically failed to keep in the limits that corals can survive in naturally. That is the easiest thing.
Have we reached the tipping point? I mean, is there a time where if we don't do it by a certain number of years that they're going to be all gone?
You know, we are projecting that the majority of the world's reefs will be dead by 2050 if we do not really start to address the drivers of climate change. And that, you know, when I say that out loud, Ira, I have to say it's just heart-wrenching because these systems are so beautiful. And frankly, the solution is so simple. It's not that complex for us to lift this big collective effort that it will take to reduce fossil fuel burning. It's just not that difficult.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Jeff, that you're a great believer that once people get to really see this, this will be, as you say, more convincing than melting ice in Antarctica. And I know you believe that people are totally oblivious to this because it's underwater. They don't get to see this.
We did a film. Our previous film was called Chasing Ice, and we spent 5 years documenting glacial landscapes. And I thought I knew everything there was to know about climate change. And being exposed to the oceans, it was starting all over. Like, I knew nothing about this, and I was shocked by how little I knew about this story. The biggest takeaway for me was that 93% of the heat trapped on the planet from climate change is being absorbed into the ocean. The ocean is just getting hotter and hotter. So if people are wondering about air temperature and how much the air is changing and how much, you know, does 1 degree matter, does 2 degrees matter, when you think about the ocean absorbing heat, you can think of it like your own body, like your body temperature. So if the average temperature is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, if your body goes up a couple of degrees, if you have a 101 or 102 degree fever, you won't be able to survive that long with that type of temperature rise. And that's exactly what's happening in the oceans right now. I had no idea how significant the changes were that are happening in the ocean until working on this.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with a new film called Chasing Coral. It's going to be out on Netflix. When is it being released on Netflix?
It is live already. It went live this morning at midnight.
This morning. How difficult, you know, you sound very passionate about this, Jeff. How difficult was this for you emotionally to sit there and watch the coral dying before your very eyes?
Yeah. When Ruth was just sharing that about how the majority of corals will be dead in the next coming decades, it's a sobering fact. And it is very sobering to witness this firsthand. Our team was out there and we saw the pretty much complete death of this one particular reef system. It was about 90 to 95% of the corals in that area died in just a few weeks, under 2 months. And the changes were just so remarkable. None of us thought, I certainly never thought that something like that could happen that fast. And the way we were documenting it, we were scuba diving every single day, slowly watching the deterioration of this ecosystem and realizing, you know, most of the scientists, I mean, Ruth, I'm sure I don't want to speak on behalf of you, but most of the scientists that we've met have been working on this ecosystem because they love it, because it's just so beautiful, because it's captivating, it's magical. These corals are these amazing creatures. And this project was such a challenge emotionally to get really immersed into this landscape, to see these beautiful ecosystems. And then in an odd way, our job was to document its very death and destruction. And that was a huge emotional challenge for our team.
And Ruth, what can people do to, yes. to I mean, be most people, effective?
Yeah, to be most effective, I think people just really have to embrace solutions that fit with them. So, you know, don't go on a transatlantic flight. Embrace renewable energy. Lobby your local governors. I mean, really, the people in charge. Start to really activate from the ground and say, we demand a change in the way that we are using fossil fuel. The change is going to come from the ground, and it will force the powers that be to make major shifts that will influence our environment and our climate as we move forward. And everybody can engage in that part. Everybody can be a part of this solution. And I think that's the wonderful thing about this problem of climate change. It is a solvable issue that everybody can be a party to. And, you know, in some ways, it creates the greatest challenge of our time. And I think that humans are incredibly good at solving problems. And so we just need to activate and do it.
Mm-hmm. The film, if you need some motivation, check out the film Chasing Coral. It's on Netflix. Director Jeff Orlowski, thank you for taking time to be with us today. And it's a great film. Thanks for making it.
Thanks so much.
I remember my scuba diving experiences, and places I dive, they're dead now, too. Ruth Gates, professor and director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in Kaneohe, Hawaii. Welcome, and thank you for joining us on Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ivan.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks again to Neil Rauch and Brian McCabe and the folks at NPR for helping us this week. If you'd like to write us, you can send, the old-fashioned method, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Oh, of course, we're all over social media all week long. We're taking our tweets at SciFry and also on our website. And also, of course, we're on Facebook, SciFry. Have a great week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.